And let's give 1 or 2 minutes for people to log in and be prepared. Okay, so let's begin, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the webinar, which today is dedicated to the role of the utilities sector in carbon transition. It's organized by the Carbon Transition Initiative of the Emerging Markets Investors Alliance. My name is Pavel Aberko. I'm leading the CTI. And today we are hosting an expert and an investor who will discuss the challenges and opportunities that investors face when they look at investments in the sector, with a focus on emerging markets, of course. Our audience will have a chance to ask questions to our guests, so please don't be shy and use the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen to take part in our conversation. As usually at our webinars, press is not allowed, and quotations and attributions are also not allowed. Today's event will be led by Justin Q, who is a member of the steering committee of CTI and is an experienced investor focused on ESG. As someone who has conducted extensive research into these areas, into sustainability and integrated ESG into investment process, he is well-versed in the issues that we're going to discuss. I will now pass the microphone to Justin to make further introductions and to lead the conversation. Justin, please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Pavel. And I'm not the expert here. The real expert here is Gagan, who definitely has a lot to share. And I think echoing to Pavel's point, do bring your questions because there's so much to cover. Just a quick introduction. Gagan has a vast amount of experience when it comes to renewable energy system and the emerging markets specifically. He's currently a director of the Council of Energy, Environment and Water in one of Asia's leading not-for-profit policy research institutions. And he's got vast amount of experience. So he was an advisor for the Center of Energy Finance before. He was also CFO for GMR Renewable Energy. He was also in investment banking. And also he's written a lot of publications on renewable finance. So I really strongly suggest the group here to ask all sorts of questions that you can think of, because energy transitions in emerging markets is very different. It's more complex, and we should view it as a slightly different lens. So Gagan will spend today to give some overview, to get the conversation going with some couple of slides, and then keep the questions coming, and then I will help to facilitate the conversation. So hopefully this will be a very smooth and fruitful and informative discussion for all of you. So Gagan, pass it over to you.
Hey, thanks Justin for that very flattering introduction. And thanks also to Pavel and the Alliance for this opportunity to sort of share my perspective on what is, of course, a very important topic. I do have a few slides, but before I actually get onto the slides, maybe I'll just add a little bit more to what Justin said in the form of an introduction about myself and the organization. I head up something called the Center for Energy Finance at CEW, the Council on Energy, Environment and Water, which is a not-for-profit policy research institution, or in simple terms, a think tank. And you know, one can sort of view the role of a think tank as an organization that sits in between the private sector, the policymakers, as well as the public at large, in a way connecting the dots between all those different sets of stakeholders, and kind of doing the things that none of those stakeholders, by virtue of their DNA, are positioned to do by themselves, you know. So that's us in a nutshell in terms of what we do at the council. And as Justin mentioned, you know, before I took on this role, I'd been a banker, and banking is a very simple business. As I tell my friends, it's all about either extending your bank's capital, or you don't want to do it, you know, arrange it from somewhere else, give it a fancy sounding name, and off you go. I've also been a CFO for a renewable energy company after that, which is the guy who sits on the other side of the table as the banker. And now I'm sort of looking at that space, but from a policy shaping or policy influencing from that perspective. So with that, let me just start sharing the slides that I have prepared for today. And as Justin mentioned, you know, the slides are actually just to get the conversation going, and just to sort of set the context. The more important and fun bit, of course, is the Q&A that would follow. Justin, I guess this is all visible to you?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks. So, yeah, I've already given a little bit of introduction about myself and the organization, so I'm not going to dwell too much on this slide, but get straight into the topic. And the topic, of course, is emerging market energy transitions with a focus on the power sector, both challenges as well as opportunities. I'm going to be focusing more on the opportunities in the slides, but happy to talk about the challenges as well afterwards. So you know, energy transition, big word, and it's sort of, it means different things to many people, to different people. I sort of like to think of it as being comprised of three sub-transitions. So to me, the energy transition is three sub-transitions. There's the power sector transition, the mobility transition, and industrial transition. Power sector transition is nothing but a shift from fossil fuel, fired sources of generation to renewables such as solar and wind. Mobility transition is nothing but a shift from ICE vehicles to, for example, electric vehicles. And the industrial transition is a shift from industries that use, fossil fuels for heat and other sort of other end uses, getting them to shift to cleaner and greener sources of power and heat. So that's the energy transition for, from where I'm sitting, three sub-transitions. And then you've got to ask yourself, why are we transitioning in the first instance? I mean, there's a lot of reasons, too many to get into for today's session or for these slides anyway. But, one reason, of course, is good old economics, because what's really happened is things have changed in the last few years, particularly in countries like India with good solar and wind resource. What we've seen is a sharp drop in the cost of power generated from renewable sources. And you know, that cost of power is far, far below what thermal power would cost. Of course, it comes with certain qualifications in that solar or wind power is not firm. It's not available 24/7, but be that as it may, good old economics is one principal factor that's driving the transition. Of course, decarbonization, which is nothing but reducing emissions, is generally considered one of the more important other reasons in terms of why we're looking at transitioning in the first instance. So with that background, I think it's important to appreciate that if we are looking at decarbonizing and we are looking at the transitions, the power sector is actually one of the most relevant of the three sub-transitions, particularly in the case of emerging economies. And that's because it's usually, no one's saying always, it's usually the single largest source of emissions and by a wide margin. So, when you talk about energy transition, you've got to talk about the power sector. And particularly from an emerging market, so emerging economy perspective. So just to give you an idea of how important the power sector is when it comes to emissions. So, you know, just four emerging economies out of Asia, India, Indonesia, Philippines, and Vietnam, three columns out there. The first is, you know, the total emissions in these countries are stemming or originating in these countries. In some cases, it's gross, the other cases, some cases it's net, doesn't really matter. Second column is the power sector share. The third is, of course, the declared net zero year. So, you know, in India's case, 40% of emissions coming from the power sector. In the Philippines, 30%. Vietnam, 20%. Indonesia, 14%. And of course, varying net zero years. Vietnam, of course, being the most aggressive with a 2050, and India at 2070. So that just gives you a little bit of an idea of how important the power sector is in order for any country to decarbonize and eventually get to net zero. Because it's these emissions, you know, that share, not really the share, but the underlying absolute value that they represent, which actually needs to get down close to zero. And the power sector transition then is really nothing more than, on the one hand, putting more renewables, solar, wind, hydro, more renewable capacities on the ground. And on the flip side, the other side of the story is, of course, phasing down in a calibrated manner thermal generating capacities. So what does it really mean? What does it cost? What are the investment requirements associated with these transitions? And I'm just going to give you a little bit of an idea of of what the transition, or actually the three sub-transitions are expected, or we estimate them to cost for a country like India. And again, you know, what we've done is broken down into these very three sub-transitions: power, industry, and mobility. And rather than get into detail on this slide, you know, I just want to point out and draw your attention to the last row in this table, which is that the total amount of money that India would require to get to net zero by 2070, so between 2020 and 2070, 50 years, is in the order of $10 trillion. And the biggest share of that, so out of $10 trillion, $8.4 trillion is directly attributable to the power sector. So that's to put down new solar, new wind, as well as, it's not there in the table, but also as well as for the accompanying upgrades in transmission storage. So, you know, net zero, you know, is all about the power sector in the case of India. And that's really where a lot of the money, or most of the money, 80%, 85% of the money is gonna go to. So you know, let's dig a bit deeper into the power sector opportunity, or the power sector transition. Clearly it's big, right? But what does it really look like? And what does it really span? So one way of looking at the power sector is that it covers, on the one hand, generation, in the middle is transmission, and right at the end, last mile is distribution. You know, as it so happens, particularly in a country like India, most of the opportunity is on the generation side, particularly for private investment right now, as we speak today. That's because the distribution or the DISCOMs tend to be overwhelmingly sort of state-owned, either owned by, in India's case, all owned by the respective provincial governments. So they're kind of more or less out of the, out of the sort of purview of private investment, albeit there are a couple of DISCOMs that have been privatized already, but just a handful. And transmission, again, is a space where there's already been significant upgrades in capacity in recent years. So generation, by and large, you know, is where the big opportunity is in the immediate future. So then when we sort of zero in on generation within the power sector, we ask ourselves, well, what sort of capital drives capacity addition? You know, it's infrastructure, so it's a majority debt at a project level. So about 75% on average in India, at least. But on the other hand, you know, whilst equity is a smaller portion at 25%, it's actually no less important, because there's no equity, there's never going to be any debt to to follow through with that. And then, you know, you got to ask yourself, well, how does one achieve generation investment exposure? So whether you're looking at debt, whether you're looking at equity, it's at two levels generally. Of course, I'm simplifying things right now. But, you know, you can either invest at a project level or you can invest at a holdco level. And you know, for both type of instruments, there's two routes. You know, you could either invest directly or indirectly. So, you know, with all that background in mind, I just wanted to sort of put down in a little nifty table, in a brief table, and map these investment opportunities across the instruments, equity and debt, as well as the sort of levels, project and holdco, as well as the routes, direct and indirect. I've circled certain sort of instruments in red, and that's because I'll be talking about them in a bit more detail afterwards. And that's also because they tend to be more liquid of all the sort of instruments that I've mentioned out here. But remember, one way of looking at this pretty large range of instruments is that anything that's at project level is actually closest to the cash. And if you're project debt, you are the closest to the cash. Project equity is number two. Those are the numbers in brackets. Holdco debt is number three, and holdco equity is the furthest away from cash. So it's got the most junior claim on cash flows. And I think this is important to sort of point out, because, you know, to the layperson, may just feel that investing in renewables is just, you know, one big, it's just one big thing. It's all very similar, but really there's a huge difference between the kind of risk return exposure you're getting by investing to the instruments that are closest to the cash, which of course is project debt, and a big difference in investing in instruments which are the furthest away from the cash, which is the holdco equity. Very, very different risk and return profiles. So this really is another schematic which explains what I just talked about in graphically. Typically how these RE holdcos are structured is that in general, they're nothing but capital pass-through vehicles. I mean, you may even say that they're actually nothing but non-bank finance companies. So they actually don't have any any sort of meaningful level of tangible assets on their balance sheets, at least on a standalone basis. Everything is pushed down onto SPVs, which is where the project debt is raised. And in many cases, you know, even operational overheads are pushed down onto the books of the SPVs for tax optimization purposes. So, you know, at its purest level, it's nothing but a capital pass-through vehicle whose sole objective is to capture a spread between return on capital that's coming up from the SPVs and the cost of capital that's coming from, you know, either common equity or debt or hybrid. And common equity itself at a holdco is usually a very, very thin slice. So in the entire capital stack, the actual common equity, if you were to look at it from a console basis, you know, it might even be very, very tiny portion. And, you know, that should sort of give you an inkling of the riskiness involved in investing in common equity. So I'm just going to talk very quickly about, give a little bit of an idea of the kind of instruments out there, at least on the slightly more liquid end of the spectrum that investors can look at. So what I've done out here is mapped out some current bond yields or yields or current yields for several different types of fixed income instruments. We've got the Treasury, and which is the Indian 10-year Treasury bond yield, as well as the NTPC bond yield. NTPC is the National Thermal Power Corporation of India. These are rupee denominated. And then the other three are US dollar denominated. I think without really getting into the nitty gritty, of course, one point to emphasize here is that you would imagine, and rightly so, that rupee yield would be higher than USD yield, which is the case. The top two lines are rupee, the bottom three are USD. And you know, by and large, what we see is, I mean, without really splitting hairs, by and large, what we see here is largely flat yields, right? There's not a huge variability. Of course, there was a big bump post-COVID, which is on the extreme left-hand side of a post-lockdown, which is on the extreme left-hand side of the chart. But you know, you've got fairly predictable levels of yields on these instruments. You can ignore the Azure Power rise in yield, which is due to some company-specific issues, which I'll get into a bit later. So that's one way you can get exposure as an investor on the fixed income side to renewables or to the energy transition in a way that you are closest to the cash. And typically how these bonds really come into play or how they come into existence is that these bonds are usually issued to refinance operating projects or operational projects or project debt on the books of SPVs, which are backing operational projects. So what you're getting is exposure to cash flow, which is generating from day one. Another way of getting exposure to that instrument or that cash flow, which is closest to the cash, is actually investing in infrastructure debt funds. And you know, you're investing debt out here again. So just to give you an idea, I've just picked up examples of four infrastructure debt funds in India. And I've got the size as well as the portfolio exposure on this chart, on this table, sorry. And you know, I mean, you've got multi-billion dollar funds out here, save the one which is sponsored by Kotak. So, you know, billion plus all the way up to close to 2 billion. And I've picked these because they all have a fairly large exposure to renewables. You know, in the case of L&T Infra, it's, you know, 65, 66 or 2/3. It's more in the case of Kotak and, you know, very similar numbers of a very similar share of renewables for the other ones. So again, this is another great, interesting way to get exposure to the energy transition in a country like India. And a rather interesting way to get exposure in a stable sense. So moving on to holdco equity, which as I explained earlier, is at the other end of the spectrum, you would imagine a lot more volatility, a lot more variability in performance. And sure enough, you know, what I've mapped is a few renewable energy, shares of a few renewable energy developers. So this is equity at holdco level. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 out there, actually 5, and then I've got the Sensex, which is nothing but the index, you know, in India. And I've rebased them to Jan 2020. So, you know, just before the pandemic hit. Before we get into the stock price returns, just to give you an idea, this is the table on the bottom right-hand side on how big these companies are. You know, Adani Green has got a market capitalization close to $50 billion. So, I mean, not small potatoes out there. And then, you know, you've got companies like Renew, which has got a market capitalization of about $2.8 billion, NTPC about $21 billion, and the other two much smaller. But if you look at their operational renewable energy capacities, which is on the right, again, for NTPC, this is just their renewable portfolio. Their total operational capacity is in the order of 50 gigawatts. But, you know, not a huge difference in terms of how big they are in terms of the operational capacity. And, you know, remember, this operational capacity is generating the same thing that the other one does, that the other company does, which is electrons, right, flowing through the grid. But look how big the difference is in terms of how these companies have performed, right? You've got a company like Adani Green, which in the span of 2.5 years is almost 13x. I mean, talk about a multi-bagger out there, right? At the other end of the spectrum, you've got a company like Azure, which has lost 70% of its value. You've got the broader index, which is 1.5 times over the same period. And of course, you've got companies like Inox Wind, which are 2.7x in that 2x, in that 2.5 year period. So big, big difference in terms of how the share price, which is that holdco equity, performs four companies that are essentially doing the same thing, which is selling power to the grid. You know? And it all gets down to, you know, a whole host of issues, whole host of factors. The way your holdco is structured is one of them. The way your holdco is leveraged and to what extent, et cetera. And of course, investor perception in terms of future growth, which is what is driving a lot of the performance of a company like Adani Green. So, you know, in conclusion, to wrap up and get to the discussion, you know, I just want to emphasize and remind everybody that today's discussion was focused on one of the three sub-transitions, which is the power sector, one of its components, which is generation, and one kind of investment, which is liquid or traded. You know, if you're not really into the liquid or traded end of the spectrum, there's a whole range of ways you can get exposure to this transition. And you know, I just want to then emphasize that, you know, there are ample investment opportunities in India as well as other countries, other emerging economies that go beyond this small subset. You know, the power sector transition is not the only transition, as I said. You know, there's mobility, there's industrial decarbonization, and there's sort of illiquid ways you could get exposure. So just invest and hold, and then you know, exit after 4, 5, 6 years. And you know, the mobility transition in India is unfolding at a really, really fast pace. And the industrial decarbonization too holds, you know, the potential for mega dollar investments. So I'm gonna stop there and stop sharing my screen and turn it over to Justin.
Thank you so much. That was a really, really insightful and presentation. Very, very thought through. Not many questions come in yet, but I just got a few to just keep the conversation going. And I think throughout the presentation and when we sort of talk about it during the prep, one thing that really came across a lot is there is a lot of investment opportunities out there. There's a lot to build, there's a lot to do, and certainly things are set in motion. Now, us sitting in London, and I think some of you who sit in Europe, you probably hear a lot in the press and a lot of talks to say that people in the West keep saying that emerging markets are not doing fast enough in energy transitions. If they look at things like India, the net zero target is 2070, China is 2060, and then they're still building coal power plants. You know, what's going on? So I think it'd be good to hear your perspective of, if you're looking at all these old energy systems, how should the developed country, also for the West, whichever term we want to use, view energy transition in emerging markets?
Yeah, you know, it is that mega, you know, that trillion dollars investment opportunity that I mentioned it is. And there's actually nothing holding back countries. Not as if developing countries are dragging their feet in terms of transitioning, because, you know, as I said today, I use the example of solar, it is cheaper than thermal by a big margin. So there is an incentive for countries to transition. That's you know, that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, there's energy security to think about, and there's also capital to think about. You know, the amount of capital that we're talking about, those hundreds of those trillions, and I'll just actually talk about a smaller number. I'll talk about 2030, which is just 8 years, you know, just 8 years away. The investment requirement for our own estimates at CW for India to achieve its 2030 target, just for generation, is in the order of 200 billion. Now you may say, you know, how come 200 billion for 10 years and so many trillions for the next, you know, 40? That's because as you get closer to net zero, your the capacities you put on also rise. So you know, it's a rising curve. But anyway, you look at 2030, the number is 200 billion. But you know, the Indian banking system, the entire banking system's exposure in India to everything power sector today is about $80 billion, you know? That's commercial banks. Add the non-banks, that's probably another $80 billion. So if you're talking about $160 billion, that's the amount of credit coming from the banking and shadow banking systems, you know, from those two systems to everything power, it's inconceivable that another $200 billion will be forthcoming just for, you know, just for renewables. So that's one big reason why you can't just build it overnight, because there's just not enough money out there to build it overnight.
But that's definitely a very interesting point, because again, like some of the funds, investment funds out here that invest in emerging markets, they keep saying things that, oh, we want to invest in green assets, we want to invest in energy transition. They say, but there's no enough investment opportunities. I've seen green bonds funds being issued, but the feedback is that we can't really invest in green bonds in Asia or emerging markets because there's not enough opportunity. So hearing what you said and hearing what some of the people over in this part of the world say, what's the disconnect here? Is there just communication disconnect, or is it understanding disconnect, or is it just access to capital disconnect? What's causing all this disconnect at all, given that there's certainly huge opportunities?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, because and it's a very valid question, right? So what is an investor, whether you're looking at equity or fixed income, to do, right? You're sitting in London, Singapore, whatever. So where do you put your money? So one broader point I just want to make is that, you know, this is infrastructure. As I said, infrastructure gets built, in this case, at an SPV level. And an SPV level equity anyway is not readily IPO-able. And SPV level project debt is not readily securitizable into bonds as well, until such time as operational risk sort of gets mitigated and there's some sort of operational track record. So if you're looking at investing in equity, it's holdco equity that gets listed. And you know, I cited a few examples of companies that are listed. There are a lot more companies that are actually not yet listed. On the bond bit, you know, because it takes time, and because India's solar, at least, you know, its solar mission has only been around for 10 years, and maybe half that at any kind of scale, it's only now that green bonds have actually started hitting the market. And when I say now, the first green bond issuance was by Indian developers in 2014, but 2021 was actually a record year for green bond issuances by Indian developers in the international markets, where in the first 6 months of 2021, $3.6 billion per our own analysis that we put out in our own report, $3.6 billion was raised by Indian developers in the international markets in the first 6 months. And so that's more than any full calendar year in history. And the year ended at $5.5 billion. And I might add that 50% of these volumes were placed with Asian accounts, and the balance split half of 25-25 between American and EMEA. So you know, there's a natural cycle, or natural gap, I would say, not cycle, natural gap between the time when projects get up and running and the kind of capital that backs it. And then between that point and between the time the cash flows are securitized into whatever equity through a holdco or bonds through a pool of projects that are put together and money is raised to refinance bank loans.
Yeah, great. Questions are piling in, which is great. So One thing I'm always curious, actually, and I think one of the attendees actually asked a similar question as well, is in terms of capital, attracting more capital into energy transitions, what do you think is the main barrier? Do you also see government intervention or initiatives coming in to actually help to break down some of those barriers? So it's a two-part question. What do you think is the main barrier, attracting more capital? And the second part is, what sort of governmental policies and signal do you see as something more concrete, like what we've seen in EU? You have the Repower EU, Fit for 55, the US, you have got the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, things like this. How do you see the barriers and also any governmental initiatives?
Right, yeah. So, you know, I think target setting is actually really important. It sort of gives investors a certain idea of what trajectory the government is, or the policymakers are setting for the energy transition. So that's kind of big picture stuff. But of course, you need to have policies that help guide that capital towards that target. And in India's case, and again, I'm talking about generation here right now, because that's what we that's what I sort of zeroed in on in my slides. We're happy to talk about other aspects as well, but at least for generation, in a country like India, you know, you've got 40 plus DISCOMs, so there's a huge range of credit quality. These are the guys buying the stuff you as a generator produce, which is the power, right? So very difficult to assess for a lot of investors, a lot of lenders, even Indian lenders, you know? So one way to sort of overcome that barrier, which the policymakers did in India, was to actually get PPAs to be executed by quasi-sovereign entities and then have back-to-back power sale agreements. So in a way, shielding the developer or the generator from the credit risk evaluation aspect. So that's one, you know, have a solid credit sit in between the buyer and seller of power. The other thing, which is not, which doesn't get enough press or, you know, doesn't get enough coverage, is reverse auction for price discovery. In India, India was amongst the first countries to actually have, to move away from FIT, particularly for solar. And, you know, the developers may sort of complain about falling tariffs, but there's two sides of the story, right? I mean, you're not going to have huge amount of willing buyers for expensive power. So you countries are where they are. India is at 100 plus gigawatt of solar and wind because it's cheap, you know? And I think the third thing is land, things like land aggregation risk, which is also very important, where it takes a lot of land to set up huge solar plants. And the authorities in many instances have also gone and aggregated or assumed that risk in the form of establishing plug and play solar parks.
Thanks a lot for that. And maybe just moving on, I think some of the questions here ask about assessing some of these contracts and also the doing due diligence on the investment itself. So I think there were a few questions on this actually. So one is pretty much to just get some feedback and suggestions from you, some good resources available when conducting analysis on some of these power investment, things like ratings or credit rating agencies. And the second part of the question is people are asking, should the emerging markets be held for the same construct of energy transition as developed markets? Example, if emerging market has only 40% electricity coverage, what is the priority, quick electrification or transition? So yeah, one is project specific and one is pretty much looking at more the whole systemic wide piece.
Well, yeah, resources, I'd say check out our website, www.cw.in, because it's whatever we do as a not as a policy research institution is actually put out there for free, you know. And there's a lot of interesting stuff out there, frankly. All the reports are there. So most of the numbers I've cited today, if not all of them, come from reports that CW has published. And you know, the Center for Energy Finance publishes in many formats, long form reports or even short form analysis. So, do look there. I mean, I think in terms of other resources, it's a bit difficult to say, right? It really depends on what aspect of the sort of due diligence or understanding one wants to do, right? If I were to just break it up, break up the issue in terms of at a project level, and you know, the closest to the cash, the project bonds, for example, or the bonds that are, I'm sorry, not the bonds, in this case, I'm talking about the project debt, which is extended by banks, which also, by the way, is rated, because by law, by regulation, anything above a certain threshold dollar value has to be rated, even if it's a term loan. We've got a report out there which tracks how these project how this project debt has evolved, how the ratings have evolved. And we see that in the last 3, 4, 5 years, there's been a secular up move in the ratings of this project debt, you know. That is a good resource to look at not specific issuer ratings, but how the market by and large has evolved, or how the perception has evolved, how the quality has evolved. And sorry, what was the second part, Justin?
Yeah, it's asking about looking at energy transition projects in the developing markets, should they be taken into the same accountability as for developed markets? And what's a quicker way to transition?
You know, I think there's a lot more similarity between a renewable project in a developing economy and or a developed economy versus, say, a coal-fired plant or other forms of power generation, you know? And that's because, that's simply because the business is very similar. You put up a solar panel or you put up a wind turbine and you sell to an off-taker. There's no differences or complexities or supply chain complexities in getting the fuel to your site. There's no logistical issues, no logistical challenges. So I would say that putting up a project and generating power is very similar. I'm not saying it's the same, but very similar whether you're sitting in a developed economy or whether you're sitting in a developing economy. The difference is the off-taker credit rating, getting a handle on how creditworthy the off-taker is, how regular the off-taker is in paying bills. And that's really the big difference in this business.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you, and just my thought as well, just answer to the attendee who raised that question, and also back to the resource question, it really is, you can't really use a standard standard sort of ratings to assess this, because there is obviously a lot of local nuances. For example, whether you build, you need to understand by building a solar panel, where are you building it? And what resource are you using to build it? Is your solar modules and cell made in countries that may have human rights violation, for example? And how do you try to outweigh that? And also the local community impact as you sort of build out the projects. And because that could affect your permitting timeframe and all those things. So you could almost case by case basis. So it's very difficult to say that company A is building a solar panel, they are great, using a mass industrial scale analysis is quite challenging. And I think to the second point about whether they should be held to the same standards, well, why not, right? Because I don't think anybody wants to build something and create other problems. I think this is a great opportunity for us to build something that could solve future problems as well. So I completely agree with you on that. Hopefully that helps wrap those questions up. There's some more specific questions here on some of the bonds, so I'm just going to read it out here. I think one is, I think one of the attendees is interested to know what's the current tenant appetite in the market for project bonds, because based on the presentation you show, projects may have 25 to 30 years timeline to be completed.
Well, that's a good question. So yeah, so you know the bonds that have been issued or that I cited, they actually take out project loans, and the project loans are of course extended by the banks or the non-banks. Those project loans tend to be even up to 18 years against a PPL life of up to 25 years. But when you swap it into a bond or you take it out to bond, the tenor gets shortened quite a bit. So for the overseas list, for the overseas issuances or the dollar denominated bonds, we've seen tenors of 5 to 6 years. That's also largely due to the fact that that's as far as the hedging window goes, So you don't want to be servicing USD with INR without hedging. So yeah, there's a trade-off there, tenor for sure. And by the way, I mean, even if you would ignore that USD bit and look at just the bonds that have been issued domestically in the Indian capital markets, there've been two in the last 12 months. So there's no hedging issue there. But both could only manage a 3-year tenor, and they were both taking out 16-year loans. So there's a big, significant trade-off that you need to deal with. Of course, on the flip side, there's a huge advantage in pricing. So it depends on if, you, as a CFO, you're saving money on the coupon, but you're going to be busy every 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. And somebody asked a question about NTPC. So I think the question is about how is the NTPC, which is a state-owned enterprise, how is their role in decarbonization, and how sensitive are they to investor pressure?
Well, I don't know about the second part of the question, because I'm not qualified to answer that, but What I can say is that I think they've, and this is, you know, if you just search publicly, they've clearly stated their ambitions to grow the renewables portfolio. It's already 2 or 3 gigawatt, as I mentioned in that slide. So they're not only are they directly, you know, they're not only directly participating by developing projects and winning capacity, they're also participating by being the through the trading subsidiary, by being the entity that is buying the renewable power generated by private developers and on selling it to the discourse.
And a bit more technical question here. Somebody was asking you about the variations in the multiples for the renewable producers. Examples, Adani Green versus NTPC, when I believe the operations in gigawatts are not vastly different.
Yeah, that's a question I ask myself a lot as well. No clear answer. Apart from, you know, complete faith in confidence in the Adani name and ability to execute projects. But one thing I will say is that you know what Adani as a group did 5 or 6 years ago was split their businesses so that, you know, what you've got here is a pure play renewables producer. They've got separate transmission company, all listed separately, which is different from some other larger infrastructure groups that have, you know, a bunch of businesses under their fold. But again, that doesn't answer the question because Renew Power or Azure Power is also a pure play renewables developer. So why is, and by the multiples don't even make sense out here. It's, you know, it's as the questioner rightly pointed out, not a huge big difference in operating capacity, which is doing the same thing, right? Selling power, which is the ultimate commodity, to the same buyers.
Yeah. And maybe just another sort of technical-ish question here. How are dividends usually denominated? Is it usually local currency issue that requires hedging, or most bonds are in sort of dollars or euro denominated?
Yeah, so far, you know, one of the sort of idiosyncrasies with India is that the bond market is actually smaller than the equity market in general. I'm talking, you know, the size, the market cap, if you will. Whereas in most, you know, mature economies, the bond markets are much bigger. Secondly, the bond market is extremely credit quality conscious because the folks that dominate are the pension funds and the insurance companies and the banks, and they have mandates to sort of not invest in anything below a certain rating. So most of the bonds so far have actually been issued overseas. But this is an area which we feel actually needs to be addressed, where you get the local bond market to be receptive. So, you know, as I said, when you're talking about hundreds of billions and trillions, it's not just one engine that's going to fire and support it. It's going to be everything. It's going to be local banks, local bond market, overseas banks, overseas bond markets.
Yeah, you need to bring all the different channels of capital together. And the very last question here from the floor actually is a bit of a crystal ball question. So they're asking you about your thoughts on the recently introduced electricity reform bill. Is it likely to pass both the House of Parliament? And would it benefit investors by reducing the issues of large DISCOM overdues?
Yeah, I'm going to elegantly pass on that because I haven't unpacked it. So, you know, I don't want to venture into some, I don't want to speculate. But you know, by and large, I think one important way of looking at the Indian market, and this is not directly answering it, but is that electricity is on the concurrent list of the, you know, of the Indian constitution, which means it's got central as well as state, you know, oversight. And India's got, you know, almost 30 odd states. Many states have more than one DISCOM, and that's why you've got 40 plus DISCOMs. So anything to do with the power sector, it's nation central as well as state. And I'll give you an example of how, even with the best of intentions, things sometimes don't really work out. And that's got to do with something called a renewable power obligation. So, you know, the center sets out an RPO trajectory every year. And, you know, it says, well, how much should obligated entities, and obligated entities by far are DISCOMs. it's not the end consumer, it's the DISCO. What share of their purchase should be renewables? And the definition of renewables has just recently changed to include hydro. But be that as it may, what share should it should be solar plus wind plus hydro? And it's about 20% odd. So that's great. That's target setting. That's direction. But the reality is there's a large number of states that have in the past not met those targets. Neither have they met the targets, and neither have they bought renewable energy certificates, which are have been created specifically to allow them a sort of a cap and trade system to meet artificially meet those targets. So that's where that sort of system tends to falter sometimes, where you have a target, you have a clear mandate, but then you've got states which have a lot of ways of getting out of jail for free. You know, they have ways of creating those passes.
Yeah, it's not just India. I think the US is pretty similar as well. You've got the federal side target, and then the states do their own thing. And Europe, yeah, you have the big EU umbrella plan, but member states, every country has their own sort of plan as well. So yeah, it's not just India that's challenging. I think it's quite similar in a couple of big countries around the world. Right, I think we're almost at time. I just wonder, you know, for attendees here today, you know, if they're looking into investing into emerging markets power generation, which I'm sure some of them already do, what would you be your sort of one thing you want to tell them as a walk away?
You know, what I mentioned a couple of times, really understand what end or how close you are to the cash flows. Understand the instrument you're buying or investing in, how close or far away, and understand the risk and return profile. So, you know, don't invest in equity thinking it's going to have the sort of riskiness or risk and return of a bond.
Thank you so much for that. I think that makes a lot of sense. Definitely something to keep an eye out on. I'll pass it back to Pavel.
Thank you, Gagan. Thank you, Justin. I'd like to express our gratitude for taking your time and effort to prepare this presentation and to have this lively discussion. And of course, I thank our audience for joining the conversation and for sending some really interesting questions. And finally, of course, I invite our audience to monitor their emails and LinkedIn feed for information about upcoming webinars and other events. We have a conference coming in November. And for the CTI, our next webinar in October will be dedicated to the role of agriculture and food supply chains in carbon transition. I hope you will be able to join it. And finally, our EMIA members will soon be able to enjoy a research brief on the utilities sector, reflecting some of the topics that we discussed today and more. So members, please keep an eye on our communications and log into our website. With this, once again, thank you everyone. All the best and have a good day. Thank you.